You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
And thank you for joining us. Also across the World Wide Web, and if you'd like to get on the internet and podcast the discussion of our first hour or our second hour or any of our first 2 hours on a Sunday night, you can, abc.net.au/Sundaynights, and click your way through to getting the podcasts on ABC Radio. In our first hour, we were discussing religious toleration in Australia. If you'd like to participate in that conversation a little later on, you can in the chat room, 1300 800 222. We also have our regular bits and pieces, the Inquisition, and a postcard tonight from New Guinea, and the chat room with Christabel Chamaret. Right now, however, Margie Cook has just returned from monitoring the elections in Kenya, helping to establish them. A troubled country with a troubled future? Well, perhaps. By way of introduction, Margie selected a few pieces of music. One of them is the arrangement of Amazing Grace from the movie As It Is in Heaven.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now
Amazing Grace, that version from the soundtrack of As It Is in Heaven. You may have seen the movie. It's a favourite of our guest, Margie Cook. Margie, welcome.
Thank you, John.
You're one of those who've spent your life trying to get out of Australia. Most people in the world are trying to get into the country, but you've spent much of the last few years going to some of the more interesting places in the world. Most recently, you've returned from Kenya, where you were among that group helping supervise the election campaign. What took you off into this course of life?
Well, in 2001, when I was working with the Human Rights Commission here in Australia, I kind of hit the glass ceiling and wondered what to do next. And having spent 15 years by that stage with Channel 9 also working on elections, a friend in the Australian Electoral Commission said, why don't you send your CV off to the United Nations? So I did. And 2 weeks later, I was offered a job managing an election program in Nigeria for the 2003 elections. And so I've been doing that ever since.
Let's talk a little bit about what sort of qualifications you need to get into this area. Your original background was in law, was it?
Way back when. But elections are a broad beast. There's everything from the technical administration of an election through to building the capacity of the context within which elections happen, and that means working closely with the media. It might be media training or media monitoring, working with civil society groups.
So this is really helping newly developing democracies set up the infrastructure that will help them conduct elections. And it's not just where you put the ballot boxes.
It's way more than where you put the ballot boxes. And it's not just newly developing democracies, it's democracies and governments in transition. In the Nigerian election of 2003 was a transition election, as was their one in 2007, a somewhat worse transition election than 2003. Kenya was also a transition election just last year as well. If you want to be frank about it, they've had independence for 44 years, but the election in 2007 was the first competitive election they'd ever experienced.
So this is helping countries develop the concept of a loyal opposition and how one fights it out in that sort of arena rather than the one-party state model.
Yes, indeed. And it's a very difficult birth to multi-party politics, from tribal politics or the big man kind of politics or one-party state politics to a political arena where everybody's voice has an equal chance of victory. We're still a long way from that.
When you first got into this, do you think some of your assumptions may have been a bit naive? You know, I'll go off and help this small country off on a way to sort of light and peace and the sort of glorious hills of liberal democracy?
If I did have that, and I remember a friend sending me an email about, oh, Margie, you know, taking democracy to the world. And, I mean, there is an American NGO called IFAS whose slogan is democracy at large, which I find really quite offensive. But that gets rubbed out of you very quickly if, you know, as soon as you arrive in Nigeria and you realise just the complexity that you might have arrived in, or you go somewhere else. I spent some time in Sierra Leone, in Cambodia, in Afghanistan. And each place is different, each place is very complex, and each place, if you had any romantic notions about it, are fairly quickly eliminated when you're faced with reality.
You've spent now, as you say, 15 years in this work. One of the people who I know has spoken on this program about it and has also worked very vigorously in the area for a number of years is somebody like Brian Burdekin. To what extent do people like him, as Australians going out into the world, really begin to make a difference?
I think we do make a contribution. I saw Brian most recently in Kenya, where he was doing some work with the Kenyan National Commission on Human Rights, which was established initially with his help to some extent, but the current chairperson of that organisation had been a vigorous human rights campaigner for many years in an NGO. And that organisation is at the forefront today in Kenya of championing things like judicial killings, police killings, human rights abuses, trying to encourage people to think not of themselves as Kikuyu or Luos or Kalenjin or any other tribal group, but as Kenyans, where tribal differences ought not to be the reason for macheting each other to death. And that history of the experience in Australia and the breadth of experience we bring adds a dimension to the local experience, just as theirs adds dimensions to ours.
So you're really working on a number of fronts here. You in the work you've been doing, narrowly focused on a particular aspect of the elections, and this spreads right across to people like Brian Burdekin, working on a much broader canvas of human rights principles, which help set up the framework to allow the sorts of things that you're doing to take place.
That's true, although when you are talking about elections, you're talking about also a broad canvas. As I said, the work that I've done for the last 7 years in Africa has involved working with civil society and faith-based organisations in very broad-based civic and voter education. It's involved training of the police in non-violent policing of political rallies and giving equality of treatment to political parties, ruling parties as well as opposition, because you find that, for instance, in Tanzania, where I was for 2 years, the police were allowing the ruling party's campaigns to run overtime. They were allowed to truck in lots of people in the backs of trucks and so on. And if the opposition tried to do that or have a campaign that went 1 minute beyond 6 p.m., you know, there would be trouble. So you go from that to working with media and training the media on the principles of basic, reporting.
Fair reporting.
Fair, accurate, unbiased, impartial.
We don't
equity
know what that
access.
Means in our own country, Mark.
Well, you have to have some ideals in some of this, and a lot of what you do is aspirational to some extent. And there's no way you're going to sort of change the world in 5 minutes flat. You've got to be realistic about what you're doing also. But you have to have some baseline from which you're working and some goal that you're trying to achieve. And that may be a long time. It might be another generation before you reach that kind of fair, equal playing field for everybody. And what you do is bring in, what experience and expertise you have to help that along the road a bit.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Margie Cook, Australian civil society activist, worker with the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, various other agencies over the years, currently just returned from working on the election process in Kenya, which is still before us in the newspapers. Maggie, let's have another piece of music, then we'll come back and talk to about one or two other things. Here's another piece you've chosen, one of your favourites. This is Roy Orbison and K.D. Lang. A little nostalgia trip here.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Crying.
I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while. Then I saw you last night. You held my hand so tight. When you stopped to say hello, you wished me well. You couldn't tell that I'd been crying over you, crying over you. Then you said so long, left me standing all alone.
And K.D. Lang, Crying. A selection of our guest, Margie Cook, who's not crying. She's got a big smile on her face, having just returned from Kenya. Is it a smile of relief, Margie, or a smile that, well, at least something was accomplished?
I am going back, early next week, so it's not necessarily time to feel relieved just yet, and it's still quite, the country is still in deep crisis.
We'll come back to Kenya shortly. We spoke earlier about the breadth of experience you had, but there must have been some seminal anecdotes for you which just made you feel you wanted to keep at this work. Where did it begin for you?
The first really important overseas visit for me was in 1990 to Romania. That was immediately after the Ceausescu regime fell. And that was for World Vision at the time. And the purpose of that visit was to talk about the plight of abandoned children in orphanages.
The Romanian orphanages were something we heard much about on the news. And there were those horrible photos of kids in the most appalling conditions.
Well, I remember in one orphanage in Constanta, which is on the Black Sea, going into this place where kids had never been outside, they'd never seen the sun, they'd never seen blue sky, and one in four kids in that place had AIDS. And there was a little boy, he must have been, you only knew he was a boy because he had teeth in his mouth. He wasn't a baby, but he was skeletal and tiny, and he was dying, and he would have died within the next 12 hours and so on. And he just had a little wail coming out and surrounded by these beefy nurses wearing rubber gloves up to their elbows. So he didn't even have the comfort of a human touch as he died. And you think, you know, God, you know, there is something dreadful about the way we treat other people if this is what it comes to for your most vulnerable, innocent sort of beings.
And it's not just about individuals, it's about society, civil society, the way it's structured.
It's very much about civil society and the way it's structured and about hypocrisy and the way in which people portray themselves and their beliefs and the way in which they conduct themselves and so on at a very big societal level. It's why I never go to church in these African countries. I cannot bear the idea of sitting in a congregation of people praising the Lord in, you know, the most energetic way and going out and abusing someone because they're not of the same race. It doesn't sit comfortably with me. And also across many of the African countries, the exploitation of the poorest by people who anoint themselves the bishop of this or that, you know, peculiar sect or church for the purpose of making money, just it really sickens me. And so I tend to stay away from that. And you see that sort of level of corruption at an organised level, and you can just imagine how people then behave and think at an individual level.
A lot of people are saying, though, the way to deliver aid these days is not government-to-government aid, but through the various voluntary agencies that do exist, like World Vision, like faith-based agencies. You're suggesting that they're just as prone as everybody else, not World Vision, but other agencies are just as prone as everybody else to the failings of and temptations of corruption.
Well, of course they are, and those agencies are corporate beings. I mean, they may be charities, but they have massive budgets of many, many millions of dollars. The United Nations in some countries now has a policy whereby money is provided directly to the government core budget for various things. And at the other level, you've got small faith-based organisations, for instance, who work very closely with communities. In all of that, you have the good and the bad. There are very positive examples of really good work being done, and there are some appalling examples as well. So I don't think one is better than the other. I think what you have to look for is appropriateness, what organisations have the capacity and the skills and the relationships and the standing and the respect with the community to deliver aid in a transparent and accountable way.
And that's where you've been focused, on helping establish the structures for transparency?
To some extent. I've been dealing with very large budgets. The budget I had in Kenya was $12 million, and that was to work with a range of organisations and so on, for which you have to account for every single cent. There has to be a paper trail and so on. But also in working with local organisations to build up the capacity of local organisations to also be more independent, to be able to receive funds, to develop their strengths, to develop their corporate expertise, because the whole purpose of someone like me being there is to walk away at the end of the day and not have everything collapse because you depart. So sustainability and effectiveness are really fundamental principles in whatever that you're trying to do.
We've wandered a little away from that Romanian example, but what you said that Romanian example first ignited your sense that civil society was responsible. Mm. So where does that take you then? You mentioned Cambodia as an example. Now, Cambodia still hasn't made that transition, has it?
No, it hasn't. And in fact, some people working in Cambodia feel that maybe Cambodia's better future lies in a structure such as Singapore's, you know, a benevolent dictator rather than multi-party democracy, because that's their tradition, and it's a huge leap to move from that kind of politics to a completely different mentality. And you can't impose democracy and you can't impose multi-party politics on communities either. So you have to work within cultural understandings and structures and not just assume that what the experience you bring is the best or most appropriate.
Does that mean human rights aren't universal?
Well, some people argue that they're not. Some people argue, for instance, when it comes to election observation, there are African standards for observation. I don't believe that, nor do I believe that there are human rights standards that are applicable to one particular part of the world or another. I do think human rights are universal.
And so the extent to which we are on the path to them varies from society to society, and that has to be taken into account.
Yes, of course it does. And the expectations of what these principles can deliver, or new ways of governance, what that can deliver, also differs according to experience and also the capacity of leadership to change and to adapt and to move forward.
So when you're sent into a society, like you get sent off to help, you know, establish elections or election processes, do you immediately have to take a scan yourself and say, okay, how far can we push this in this environment? What are the limits to where I can go? You said in the Cambodian model, you basically have to say, well, maybe, you know, they're not quite ready for the full multi-party stuff yet.
If you're working within the UN system, you're working within the principle of perhaps the introduction of multi-party politics and the development of effective oppositions and the diversity of voices in governance. So there are parameters within which you're trying to operate, but nonetheless you have to work within what is doable as well, because imposition will only be destructive in the end.
Yes, because it really has shown out in Iraq. I mean, the side debate in Iraq was the society capable of making the leap to multi-party democracy in the way that some of the neocon ideologues had suggested it was? You know, you go in, chuck a dictator out, and democracy will bloom.
Well, it's not only that. It's that you have to balance the political agenda with the development agenda, if I can use that sort of cliche. That was one of the biggest problems in Afghanistan. I led the evaluation team in Afghanistan in 2006. I was there for a couple of months looking at the effectiveness and sustainability of the voter registration, the presidential and the parliamentary electoral processes, which cost over $320 million of international money. And what we found in effect was that the political timetable imposed by the Bonn Agreement in Afghanistan simply precluded the development agenda taking hold, so that at the end of that period of that first round of elections, you had the beginnings of a different form of governance in place, but you had no capacity, for instance, within the Electoral Commission to actually run an election for themselves, because they had, as I said, stood back like statues whilst the international community came in and did everything. Now, that was a dilemma. You know, what was the cart and what was the horse? I mean, that was a very difficult problem, but there are lessons to be learned from that sort of thing, where you have to pace both the political agenda and the development agenda so you're not doing an Iraq again.
And you're seeing in Afghanistan at the moment something of that working out, with Mohammad Karzai saying, well, look, I don't find Lord Owen acceptable. And it may be that it's not that he does have personal animus, but he's got to be aware of the balance within his own tribal loyalties, and he's actually got to be seen to be standing up for Afghanistan.
And in the Afghani parliament, you have many warlords, many, many murderous criminals who have been duly elected. And this is also a long-term issue, you know, how to develop a completely different way of thinking about governance.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Margie Cook, civil rights activist, somebody who's been involved with the UN process over many years, and also worked for a number of agencies, including the Australian Human Rights Commission, at World Vision, and others along the way. Margie, another piece of music. Your most recent experience has been in Kenya, and this music is from Kenya. Introduce it for us.
Eric Wainaina is a young musician. He's one of Kenya's most popular performers. He's about 32. He's got a master's degree in music education. His manager is his brother. He plays every Sunday night at the Club Afrique, and you can go along and dance like crazy to let off steam. But he is most popular because he's a neutral player. His songs are about justice. Old-fashioned things, freedom and justice and these kind of wonderful principles that really come from his heart, but his brain as well. But for his trouble, he's been accused more recently of being an incendiary activist by the government, while the newspapers laud him as a national treasure. He's a voice of reason and a bit of a prophet, particularly for the young.
The voice of Eric Wainaina, Who Is to Blame?
The policemen are taking possession. The students are looking for justice again, drawing their lines in the sand, each waiting to see who's a man. They're choking on mounting frustration, mourning the state of the nation. Their hearts are aflame, their blood is on fire. Stones start to fly, politicians deny. Then who is to blame? Who is behind this? Who is in the shadows? Who lights the flame of this raging inferno and watches from her window? What we need is justice, justice. Will you come help me find it? What we need is justice, justice. Will you come help me find? Tattoos, trying to make an extra shilling or two. The progress of students, it means nothing when there's no bread on the table, no money for shoes. So they take to the streets in demonstration, saying something isn't right with this equation. But the singing is stifled by rogues and rifles, uniformed police here to keep the common peace. So who is to blame? Who is behind this? Who is in the shadows? And who lights the flame of this raging inferno and watches from high?
Eric Wenana, Who Is to Blame? The contemporary Kenyan voice, a selection of our guest Margie Cook, and we're joined in the studio right now by our producer, Noel De Beer. Noel, who's recently been off to Kenya as well, and was probably there at the very same time Margie was, Noel.
We didn't know each other. We could have caught up, indeed, on the dance floor. We might have been out there dancing.
At the Club Afrique.
At the Club Afrique.
In Nairobi.
It's really something.
Sure is.
Well, tell us about a country like Kenya. Kenya, we know, has emerged here. If you go back into the 50s and 60s, one of the prime leaders in African nationalism, Jomo Kenyatta. But then you had the tragedy of the Mau Mau uprisings and the pushing of the British out. Daniel Arap Moi became the dominant figure in the country. They're now transitioning to a sort of more comfortable multi-party system, although that's the theory, is it?
Well, they're not transitioning very comfortably at the moment at all. And that's because one tribal group, the Kikuyu, have actually held power ever since independence. And whilst in 2002 the community got together to get rid of Moi, they put in place Kibaki, who came from the same tribal group. The election in 2007 was the most competitive, and the leader of the opposition, Raila Odinga, you may remember reading about him whilst you were there.
A Luo.
It was a Luo, a different community. Now, the Luo have never held power, and there was every expectation that they would win the election. Even the papers on the very last day of vote counting still had Odinga ahead in the polls and ahead in the votes. And then, at, 1 minute to midnight, that victory was snatched from beneath him. And that is what has upset Kenya now, the expectation that another community would win and the determination of one to hold on at all costs.
How has that affected ordinary people on the ground? Because you've seen an outbreak of civil strife in a country that people had supposed could survive the rough and tumble of a transition in political life. But instead, it's almost that it's been an excuse for a visceral outbreak of, as you say, communal violence. Noel, you spoke to us of the slums of Kibera when you were there and the tragedy that was there already. On top of that, you now have to overlay what's happened in the election campaign.
Well, I was struck, I have to say, by tribalism, and the Africans themselves talk constantly about tribalism and how to deal with it. That you may be a Kenyan national, all right, but, you know, I was staying with Kikuyu friends who would quite readily point out to me who their Luo friends were, and everybody knew which tribe they belonged to, and they joked a little bit, like, you know, Irish joke about Scots or Australians joke about Irish, or and there were these inter-tribal jokes, as it were. And then in the slum of the Kibera, I noticed also you knew which village. They actually call sections of the slum a village, even though it all seems continuous to me. And the Kikuyu live here, and the Luos live there, and there's, you know, 42 tribes in that slum.
Can the election education process get down that far, Margie? How does it penetrate into those sorts of environments?
If you have a long-term civic education program, yes, you can start to think about leadership and identity and choice and so on, and being an informed voter. When you're talking about voter education, you're talking about encouraging people to come out and vote and how to do that in an informed way. The tragedy of the most recent history of Kenya is that the election process actually was very peaceful. People came out in record numbers to vote. There were 1 million new people on the voters register in 2007, mainly young people. And the process was peaceful right through to the counting of the votes, even in the polling stations. The announcement of the results and the transmission difficulties and tallying problems were a trigger for immediate post-election violence, which really fed this much longer-term, deep-seated tribal hatred that has been there for a long, long time. And it's been very shocking. A friend of mine, as I said, is the chairperson of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. He's a Kikuyu. He comes from the same area as the president. And his school, the friends he was at with school are calling him now saying, don't you identify yourself as a Kikuyu anymore? And he said, you know, you're 40 years old. When did you start identifying yourself by your tribe instead of by your own personal identity or your identity as a Kenyan or a member of the human race? There are something like 300,000 plus people displaced who can no longer live in the places that they grew up because of this tribal hatred now, and it seems to have tapped a sort of well of hatred that's been there a long time. And in Kibera and Mathera, these big slum areas of Nairobi, yes, the Kikuyu live here and the Luo live here, and the road down the middle is a no man's land where you tread and you will be hacked to death.
And as my friend Andrew Otieno said to me last week, within 10 minutes of the announcement of the electoral result, they were receiving gunshot wound victims in his little clinic inside the slum. Straight away, these were Kikuyus who the Luo had gone after immediately.
Yes, and that's happened right through the Rift Valley as well. But what is really shocking is that for all the work that was done, you know, by the civil society, by the faith-based leaders, by the SUPKEM, which is the Muslim Council, by the Hindu Council, by the Catholic and Anglican archbishops and all of the groups they represented, nobody predicted or conceived of the outbreak of violence at the depth and the scale to which it's actually happened. There was always going to be violence, no matter who won or lost the election.
Yet when you're there, you're also aware that it's not that far away, the Congo and Rwanda, where we had intertribal murder on a huge scale.
One of the things we did with our media training program was actually send journalists to Rwanda to go to the churchyard where the skeletons still, you know, are there in the grounds, and to see firsthand what the consequences are of hate speech as disseminated by irresponsible radio. We had a media monitoring program which specifically monitored the language of incitement and hate speech in these vernacular radio stations, where in local languages to local communities they would be encouraging hatred, calling other groups mosquitoes or cockroaches. Not cockroaches in Kenya, there were other words used.
It was Rwanda cockroach was the word, wasn't it?
Rwanda, was, in Rwanda was it was cockroach. But people were very aware of that. They were aware of the threat. And that is why such a lot of emphasis was placed on the responsibility of the press for this kind of activity. And in fact, in the post-election environment, the Media Council of Kenya has been at the forefront in ensuring that, at least in the mainstream media, the print and the radio are together in calling for peace. Not one major newspaper has ever referred to Kikuyu or Luo or Kalenjin. They never use those words because the very use of the word is an incitement.
A trigger, virtually.
So where is the incitement coming from? Is it coming from sort of local tribal leaders? I mean, when you were around, no?
Well, everywhere you go, you read on tribalism. People write on tribalism in Africa, and it's somehow about that whole European nationalism that happened 100 years ago. It hasn't really sunk in Africa yet. It's not Kenya, Rwanda still. It's not gotten to that stage.
It's still the old and British artificial dividing line.
Well, I was struck by Margie talking about not being wanting to go and worship in a church in Africa because it seemed shallow. And it's true that Rwanda is the most Catholic country of Africa, and they murdered each other on tribal grounds, and priests and nuns cooperated in that. Mm-hmm. And the same in Kenya. You see this real enthusiasm in religion, and everyone goes to church. The Anglican churches are chock-a-block. The Catholic churches are chock-a-block.
The Pentecostals are even more chock-a-block than anybody else.
I went to Winner's Church on Gong Road and had a fantastic time. It was a very strange experience. But it almost as if the sorts of things that we would compare from our own history of nationalism and the consolidation of what an Australian is or what an English person or an American is, it's not quite there in Kenya yet, it seems.
There's a lot of criminal opportunism in this as well. I mean, violence breeds violence of different natures.
And there's poverty there as well.
The poverty is dreadful, and most people are very, very poor. And so in those slums like Kibera, where people live on the smell of an oily rag,
and there is no running water and no sanitation system,
and no electricity and so on and so on, then when the opportunity comes from a bit of an excitement, then people, especially the hundreds and thousands of unemployed young men who are often, you know, roped into being into sort of private armies as well. And this was a problem in Nigeria. It's a problem, across the continent, where you have unemployed young men who have nothing to do. And so they make the most of these opportunities.
And the disparity of wealth is very obvious too. And I was saying to Margie before we came in here that the former president's house, a palatial mansion, sits overlooking the slum. And I can't for the life of me work out why you would build there if you were the president. But he clearly liked the location.
Margie, when you were working with the team that you were working with in order to sort of help structure the process towards elections, were you able to get down into the areas like Kibera and talk to people running the clinics? I mean, who are your agents down in that area to help with the civic education?
We use civil society organisations who in turn use locally engaged facilitators or educators.
And what do you mean by that?
These are people who are recruited by the NGOs. They have to come from the area within which they work. They have to have at least a minimum university degree. And they are then trained up in all of the kind of curriculum, the content, creative teaching methodologies and so on. We had over 5,000 of these over the last few months in all over Kenya, working at very local levels. And it was those people who encouraged citizens to come out and vote. They have never had such a high voter turnout in
Kenya. What was the response of those people to what happened after the event? Did those people, because they're your educated shock troops on the ground, turn around and say, well, you messed that up, didn't you? We put all this work in and the process is wrecked, or did they become agents of reconciliation? I mean, how's that played out?
I think they're more the latter than the former. I think there are many people who are feeling very betrayed at the moment. Civil society organisations who were engaged in encouraging people to think about leadership and choice and so on. And I think there is an enormous challenge in Kenya now to re-establish some credibility in participation in politics as a citizen and as an elector. That's going to be an enormous challenge over the next few years, to try and encourage people to think that the dividends of participation are actually going to be positive and not negative.
The actual building of social trust and social capital is something, you know, which is not happening very easily there. I remember reading reports, for example, of people chained to beds in hospitals because they hadn't paid their bills in Nairobi. And this was normal reporting. This happened on a normal day. There were people all through the society who didn't trust their elected representatives to be dealing fairly with them. You were hearing that all the time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in Kenya, the average turnover of politicians at each election is 75%. At least 75% of politicians get turfed out every election.
Well, that's a pretty good remedy to corruption. I mean, that indicates that there is at least something going on that is healthy about the electoral system.
Voter awareness is there.
It certainly is. But Kenyan politicians are amongst the most well-paid in the entire world, in the top three or four. Mm.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Margie Cook, who's just returned from being one of those helping facilitate the election process in Kenya. And a difficult process it's been. Alder Bean's also with us in the studio. Margie, another piece of music. This one is from an African artist, Rebecca. I feel like going home. This is a reflection of how you felt from time to time.
From time to time, sometimes you just feel like sitting down and having a good cry. And Rebecca is a wonderful gospel singer. I'm sure the home she's talking about is a much more spiritual home than the one I was thinking of. But I sit down and I listen to her and think, oh, yes, I think a good swim in the Pacific Ocean would do me the world of good.
Rebecca.
Oh, I Feel Like Going Home. Rebecca, on Sunday night, a selection of our guest, Margie Cook, just returned from Kenya, where she's been helping to facilitate the election process in a very difficult post-election environment. Noel DeBeans also with us in the studio. Margie, you're about to go back to Kenya. Is this the fact that you are still optimistic that things can be resolved, or is the UN holding a gun to your head?
No one's holding a gun to my head. I have contractual responsibilities for a start. I'm here on a week's leave. And after Kenya, I have to make a choice whether to go to Sudan or Iraq or Afghanistan. So, I mean,
they provide you some great options.
Yes. Unfortunately, the sort of work I do doesn't take you to Paris and Rome.
I mean, at least en route, you might.
Oh, but you can pop into the carnivore in Nairobi and have some impala.
Or crocodile or goat or some other unmentionable.
It's an amazing restaurant, it is.
For somebody else wishing to pursue this line of work, Margie, who is not deterred by the sort of fear of civil strife but wants to get in and do their bit, what do they do? What do you recommend to sort of young people who sort of have sort of the idealistic stars in their eyes? Do you recommend they keep them there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, where are you if you don't have a bit of idealism and a sense of positivism about the future? I mean, you may as well just curl up and die. What would you do? I mean, there are a number of things. I've come across, and particularly in Cambodia, some young Australian women who are with the Youth Ambassadors Program with AusAid, for instance, which gives young people an opportunity to go and work at minimal wage, I think, in developing countries and other environments. There was a group, I don't know what you call them now, it used to be called Australian Volunteers Abroad, but I don't know what you call them now. And that's another organisation that gives people a chance to go and work.
You mentioned World Vision earlier too, as a faith-based agency. That's one of those that's got agencies everywhere.
Oh, everywhere. I mean, World Vision, the Red Cross, CARE,
Oxfam.
There are a million different organisations, but you're really only of use if you've got something to offer. There are enough leeches in society without going to think that you're going to, you know,
save the world
and you're bringing all this, you know, wonderful expertise that everybody should bow down and grovel for. The reality is, I mean, there is a very equal exchange in terms of learning. One never comes away poorer from this kind of experience. And at a personal level, that's incredibly enriching and rewarding. But those people that do have a skill, teachers or medical personnel or doctors, we had an Australia Day dinner recently at the High Commissioner's residence. And there was a gentleman there, he was 63, great dancer, I have to say. And he was a charter pilot. And he belongs to this outfit, an Australian outfit called Red R. It's a professional outfit. They're often retired professionals who make themselves available to go to needy areas at short-term notice. And he was there for the World Food Programme, flying these planes to distribute food to the displaced people in Kenya.
So this is not just about young people. Oldies, greybeards can get into this stuff.
Absolutely. And there's a huge demand for that kind of skill. And oftentimes, particularly in the African context, for instance, older people are very highly regarded and respected and treated with a great deal of deference.
I had a friend once whose mother was about to take off. She'd recently been widowed and she was a school teacher and was about to take off to Mongolia, going to Urumqi or somewhere like that.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Really?
I've spent some time in Mongolia and it was absolutely wonderful. But yes, I mean, why should you not share that expertise if you feel that you've got something to give and you want to use your expertise in that way? Age ought to be and is no barrier.
And Noel, every Sunday night, the postcard will help explore people, Australians,
well,
doing interesting
precisely.
Things in all those sorts of places.
We're catching up with them. And, you know, Kenya, despite all the reports we're getting at the moment, it's a very hopeful place. Everywhere you go, you see Kenyans working to make things better. And they really do work hard. And against unbelievable odds from an Australian point of view at times, they keep working to make the place better.
And are extremely gracious and very, very well educated. I live right in the middle of town, and when I walk down the street at the moment, people just bowl up and say, "Welcome to Kenya. We're sorry for the troubles. I hope everything's all right." And there's a kind of, you know, please just let us get past this hiccup and back onto a more peaceful path. You know, they're very proud people. And they do identify as Kenyans. It's not just, you know, the country hasn't disintegrated into tribal factional warfare. There are elements of that going on, but I think, like the Nigerians who go to the edge of the abyss and look in and think,
maybe not.
Maybe that's not where we want to go, which is Nigeria's history. I think that's going to be Kenya's experience as well. They won't become a Rwanda.
Margie Cook, great to have you on Sunday night. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's finish with a little piece of optimism from the movie As It Is in Heaven, Gabriel's song. Why?
I just found that incredibly inspiring, as I'm sure you did also, Noel.
Oh, that's great. It's a wonderful movie.
Yes.
Wonderful song.
Gabriel's song on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Margie Cook, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
It's been a great pleasure, John. Thank you.
Gabriel's song from As It Is in Heaven. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, and coming up after the news, the Inquisition, 1300 800 222, the number to ring. Do give us a call, 1300 800 222, on Sunday night.